Welcome to this month's look at the cancer headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Bill Nelson, director of the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center at Johns Hopkins.
Bill, we're going to wade into a controversy here from the British Medical Journal started to take a look more deeply into this issue. And that's a bunch of new types of medications for type 2 diabetes that some people are saying, hey, there's a relationship between that and pancreas cancer.
Well, this is a very difficult area, and there are the beginnings of some concerns based on some of the anecdotal and case-by-case data that have been reported where people who have taken some of these new anti-diabetic drugs because they can treat diabetes without unsafely lowering blood sugar. The question is, are they at all unsafe? What's difficult is that adult onset diabetes or type 2 diabetes mellitus is fairly common and increasing in its incidence and prevalence throughout the world. These people take these medicines for very long periods of time. Diabetes is a risk factor for pancreas cancer, although most people with diabetes never get pancreas cancer, it nonetheless is associated with it. And so the concern is, do these medications make pancreas cancer more likely to appear? I think right now we'd have to say that we don't have the definitive data to say that this is the case, but there are cases that are arising. There are some evidence from animal studies that suggests there might be a link. And I think you'd have to say it's a cause for concern that needs to be responsibly investigated. The big problem, in my view, is that as these drugs are discovered and developed and tested for their primary purpose, which is to control type 2 diabetes mellitus, the studies undertaken are necessarily short. The worry, of course, for things that might lead to cancer, this might be a much more long-term, rarer complication. And it's difficult at this point with the way we follow drugs after they get on the market to be able to make these conclusions. And we need to be able to ask these questions better in our health system.
I was under the impression that the incidence of pancreas cancer was also increasing.
I think the incidence of pancreas cancer is increasing, but I should tell you that a very large number of people have type 2 diabetes mellitus. And although it is a risk factor for pancreas cancer, far, far fewer people get pancreas cancer than have diabetes. The mechanisms by which these things are related, we don't understand very well. So as we understand them better, I think we'll be able to anticipate whether more obesity, more diabetes mellitus, or whether particular interventions that control obesity or diabetes mellitus are safer or more risky vis-a-vis the development of pancreatitis or inflammation of the pancreas and pancreas cancer.
So for right now, I know diabetes is not your field, but what about people who are told that they ought to entertain the idea of one of these newer agents for the management of their condition? What would you say?
Well, I think these people need to have a discussion with their physician. There are choices for agents that can be used to treat diabetes. The choices have known side effects in the short term as well as in the long term. By working with your physician, you can figure out which agent is the best one for you.
Let's turn then to our next oldest one, but one that originated here at Johns Hopkins in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. One of our colleagues here who has identified the idea that African-American men with prostate cancer may not be eligible for what's called active surveillance when they appear to have low-risk disease.
What they looked at were prostates removed at radical prostatectomy from Caucasian men and African-American men that before surgery seemed to meet the criteria of what's known as very low-risk prostate cancer. In this group, they underwent a radical prostatectomy anyway. They elected to pursue that. And the question was, how reliable was that recommendation? Did they really have very low-risk prostate cancer when you got to look at the entire prostate? And what they found was in the African-American men, they were more likely to have higher grade disease, more likely to have cancer at the surgical margins. And in another study, they were more likely to have cancer hiding out in the front part of the prostate, the so-called anterior region of the gland that's not commonly biopsied. So then the question was, is the recommendation to pursue active surveillance as reliable for African American men?
I think this study points up something that we've talked about in lots of different disease states in the past, and that is, let us call them racial differences in how people present with cancer and also the mortality they experience as a result of that. So based on this study, and as a prostate cancer expert yourself, what would you say to an African-American man who comes to you with prostate cancer?
Right now, it's about a 1.6-fold increased risk of dying of prostate cancer at any given age for African-Americans versus Caucasians. In this particular study, what's interesting is what seems to be a biologic difference. Cancer's hiding out in in a part of the gland that's not commonly sampled by a biopsy. The good news is I think there's an emerging technology involving magnetic resonance imaging of the prostate that tends to be able to find larger tumors hiding out in funny places like the anterior region of the prostate. So what I would hope that would mean is that African-American men considering taking this approach would have access to that kind of technology so they can make the best and most informed decision going forward.
Very good. Let's turn now then to the New England Journal of Medicine, something that I thought was really pretty provocative, a look at how drug development could be more patient-centered in oncology.
Well, I think this essayist, I think, focuses on anti-cancer drugs, and I think there's a little bit of a reason for that. But I think which if you look across the country, there is a broader interest in what are called patient-reported outcomes generally of treatment interventions, not just drugs for FDA approval. A good example of that, we were talking about prostate cancer, is the patient-reported outcomes when it comes to continence, erectile function, what the patient will report versus what the physician will report versus what's in a claims database for an insurer are often quite different. And I think what the emerging bias is that patient-reported outcomes are highly sensitive to what's really happening among people who are taking these treatments, and that we need to systematically collect this information in a higher quality way. And that's really what the call of the essay was. They focused on anti-cancer drugs a little bit because there's a fairly rigorous collection of data related to safety, because many of these drugs were, particularly chemotherapy drugs, were given at the margins of safety. And so these data are very carefully collected, but they're objective criteria in a sense. What's your blood count? How many times did you get in the hospital? And what I think the concern of the essayist was is by having so much data on safety collected in this way, were we not talking as much during anti-cancer drug development to patients about how they felt, what symptoms were important to them, and the like? And if you look back across the history of anti-neoplastic drugs, things like fatigue, malaise, usually underestimated by these objective type data collected and over commented on by people who take the agent. So are we missing something by not developing a system to collect high quality patient reported outcomes? And I think that's what the call is, and I would totally agree with that.
And is that your clinical experience then, that those things are really should be factored in when we take a look at design of a therapy for someone with cancer?
Well, I think that how a patient or someone who takes a treatment or a drug really feels is the question that they most commonly ask their physician as they're beginning to consider treatment options. For instance, what's this really like? How am I really going to behave with this? How is this really going to affect me? There's the label, and then there's the question, what's really going to happen to me? That's what people want to know. And to have higher quality data for this is going to help everybody.
Okay. Finally, then, let's turn to the British Medical Journal again. Kind of an interesting thing, and again, one of these standby sorts of things, an observation. Could omega-3 fatty acids help to reduce breast cancer risk?
Well, this was a group, I think from China, actually, who conducted meta-analysis, went after a large number of studies that tested the association between intake of so-called omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids from either a marine source, i.e. fish oil, versus from a plant source, and looked at the intake of these and their effect on the propensity to develop breast cancer. Really able to look at a very large number of people, 800,000 study subjects, 20,000 breast cancer cases. And their conclusion was the intake of the omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids from fish reduced breast cancer risk by about 14%. They did not see that decrease in risk from the alpha-linolenic acid, which is the omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acid from plant sources.
Awful lot of controversy again. We're going to end on controversy here about purported benefits of fish oils. So for right now, if you were going to give a public health message to all of us, what would you say?
I think that if you take a couple steps back and look at diets that are rich in fish in general, I can't think of that many health hazards other than related to organic mercurials and the like that are concentrated in fish. But in general, a diet rich in fish and fish products appears to be a generally healthy diet. I think that conclusion stands even after this meta-analysis.
Okay. So that's a look at this month's cancer headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Bill Nelson, and I do believe in a cure for cancer.